Okay, good afternoon. So today we're gonna try to get into some real course material, but starting out with something which isn't really directly a security sort of malware thing, like most of the focus of this course, which is about virtual machines. So I'm talking about this for several reasons. So one reason is because I took Jack Davidson's syllabus and didn't change it very much. Another reason is because you're going to use virtual machines and have used virtual machines, and it's good to understand how those actually work. Another is because virtual machines provide us isolation features, ways of keeping things like bad software from affecting other things. And that's very useful for dealing with malware and other security issues, and we should understand about these tools. And they're probably used, or these techniques are used probably more than you think, at least proposed more than you think. So first, I'm going to go over some logistics things. So one thing is that there was an ethics pledge I talked about in the first lecture. It's due a week from today. After class, you can put it in that folder if you have it here. If you want a blank, after class, see me, I have blanks. Or you can print it out yourself. Anything like that. The first assignment is setting up a virtual machine environment that runs a very specific installation of Linux. So you can definitely do some of the assignments later in the semester which might require exactly that. It's due Friday. There are office hours posted on the website if you have some sort of technical problems and want to talk to me or a TA about them without scheduling an individual meeting. I also would like to note about the wait list. So I increased the capacity of this course from 80 to 90. And last I checked, we were below the capacity. So if you are still on the wait list, you probably have something keeping you from registering for this class, like a limit on hours or a hold, and you should look into that. OK, so any questions about logistics and that, those sorts of things before I move on? OK, so let's go on and talk about virtual machines. So a virtual machine, as the name suggests, is a fake machine. It's something that looks like a machine. And the question, of course, is to whom? And we're talking about, with virtual machines, to software it looks like a machine. So software has this idea that they have a machine, usually a machine that the software gets to run in itself, is sort of the notion, whatever software we're talking about. So when you look at VirtualBox, the software is some operating system, like Linux. That gets the illusion it has its own machine, even though it's running on your laptop alongside other operating systems. So it doesn't really have its own machine. And we're going to, and I'm going to use, not everyone does this, a very general notion of what a virtual machine is. And some virtual machines I'm going to talk about aren't going to look like real machines. They aren't going to look like something physical that you could run something on. They might have some made-up interface, but it's still a machine. It runs instructions, it has memory, it has storage. It has the sort of things we expect from a computer, but it's not something you'd expect to ever see implemented in real hardware. And as part of that, I'm going to have this little taxonomy of virtual machine types, and we're going to spend essentially all our time on the latter kind. But I'd like to make you aware that there are other things called virtual machines which aren't like VirtualBox. And this might be a little redundant with 3330. I apologize. So one thing are the language virtual machines. So who here has heard of the Java virtual machine? So that's a virtual machine. It's something designed for a particular programming language. But it provides what we expect from a machine. It runs instructions. It has its own notion of memory and all that. And you can think of, you know, it behaving like a dedicated processor for the Java program. That gives it the illusion it has its dedicated machine that really runs on your normal operating system. We can also speak of operating systems in general as sort of virtual machine implementations. They just implement a virtual machine which has what we call system calls, which has and things like files instead of disks. So it has a very different interface than any real machine, but it gives processes the notion that they're kind of running as if they don't care about anything else. But it's a very different interface than the real hardware would have. We'll also look at system virtual machines. you can, the way to remember this is that a system virtual machine runs an operating system. And it's basically designed to look like real hardware. As we'll discuss briefly, that maybe it doesn't look like any exactly real hardware, but it's sort of built by first saying, I'm going to emulate what real hardware does, and maybe you make a few changes after that. That's your starting point. So any questions about these categories? Okay. So let's talk about briefly about language VMs. So I said they're designed for a particular language. And these are everywhere. So you've heard of the Java virtual machine, because Java makes explicit the step of producing code for that virtual machine, those .class files you've probably seen, and running them explicitly. And the reason they have this is because it's easier than the real machine to compile to. So that's sort of what it was designed for. And it was also designed to be easy to implement. So there's sort of these two competing goals. So one is to make it easy to convert Java code to that virtual machine. But the virtual machine doesn't just take in a Java source file, which would be the easiest possible thing. It takes in something else. So it's designed to be fast to simulate on a real machine. You can have an efficient implementation. And the JVM sort of specializes in ways that you would expect no physical machine to do. So the assembly in the JVM, which is in this book, which you can find free copies of online, legitimately from Oracle, the Java Virtual Machine Specification, knows about things like objects and methods. Those are entities in this assembly language. You wouldn't expect to actually implement hardware where you could give a string with a method name and call something. That's a feature in the Java virtual machine. And it uses all stack-based instructions. So all the instructions have there's an operand stack instead of registers, and they look at the top things on that stack and push the result back onto the stack after that. And the reason they do this is because this was thought to be easier to implement in software. I think the Java virtual machine designers now regret this decision, but at the time that this was done because that was thought to be easy to do in software in a good way. And sort of relevant to what we care about in this class, the Java virtual machine has this nice properties with respect to those notorious memory bugs that are going to be the focus of a lot of the semester. You can't segfault in the JVM. You can't access invalid memory. That's just not allowed with the instructions you have. You can't leak memory either. That's just not allowed by the way the machine works. So by choosing the operands we allow carefully, we've eliminated entire classes of security bugs. And it's sort of an attractive feature of targeting these sorts of isolated environments. So I mentioned that the second category is OSs as virtual machines. That the idea of a process, that notion of a program that is running in a sort of a virtual machine that's designed by the OS to be useful. So it's a different interface than the physical hardware, not for the basic instructions. All the instructions your program runs that manipulate values in memory are the same as the real hardware. But you have system calls instead of communicating directly with the hard drive or a network. You have some higher level interface that is more convenient for the programmer to use that's implemented by the OS. And this is, in fact, a lot more complicated than real hardware. So that's not intuitive. You think operating systems, things like files, make things easier for me, and that's true. But the interface is much bigger. There's a lot more things you can do with files than you can do with a disk, which essentially just is a bunch of data you can read and write. There's a lot more types of operations. It's a much sort of bigger interface. And this is going to be an important reason why we use VMs the way we do, is the size of this interface. So it's more complicated, but it's designed to be simpler for you to program to do useful things. You don't have to re-implement TCP/IP every time you want to do something on the network. You don't have to decide on how things are going to be laid out on disk every time you want to save and load data. But as I said, we're going to spend most of our time talking about things which don't take this opportunity to design a different interface, but use the real interface. So they're going to act like real hardware. So instead of files, we're going to have a hard drive. It might not be a real hard drive, but it's going to act like a hard drive. Instead of network connections, we're going to have like an Ethernet device. It might not really be something that you can plug something into, just something implemented in software, but it's going to look like an Ethernet device. You're going to configure it as an operating system like an Ethernet device. We're not going to have things like malloc, but we're going to have the underlying hardware interface, which if you took 3330 is page tables. We're going to implement the same thing the hardware does. And all of you have seen this kind of VM because virtual machine software is ubiquitous. There's a sort of a resurgence of virtual machines. I'll get why I'm saying resurgence and not a surge of that in a second. Starting with base probably VMware, which was a 1998 startup out of Stanford, which sort of repopularized virtual machines. And we know there's all sorts of virtual machine software you might have used. So VMware, VirtualBox are probably the ones you've heard of most. There's also Parallels, which is popular in OS X. There's Xen, which is what Amazon EC2 happens to use. QEMU, which is a Linux native virtual machine, and among other things. And Hyper-V, which is Microsoft's sort of native virtual machine offering. And you've probably heard of some subset of these, at least VirtualBox, since you hopefully started the first assignment, maybe. You've seen these before. And this is what we'll be talking about most. And there's going to be two concepts, words I'm going to use, and I'd like to make sure my vocabulary is very clear, because it's easy to get confused when we're talking about multiple operating systems and how things work. When I talk about a guest operating system, I mean running inside a virtual machine. When I talk about a host operating system, I mean what's outside the virtual machine. I'm going to try to consistently use that terminology and not some other terminology. Okay. So for system virtual machines, there's basically two implementation strategies. And both of them exist and are popular in some instances. So there's the sort of traditional virtual machine where we have our virtual machine runs on top of a virtual machine monitor, but still speaks the native instruction set. So most of the time, for its computation, it's just like a normal program running directly on the hardware. But when it tries to access services that ordinarily would go to the host operating system or to the hardware that are special, we've somehow arranged for those to go to the virtual machine monitor, this application that implements the virtual machine. The other strategy is that you can take your virtual machine code and interpret it or translate it to something else. So its native code doesn't actually ever run directly on the CPU in this case, but you don't need to figure out how to make these privileged operations end up going to this virtual machine monitor. So people seem a little possibly confused. Questions? Comments on this? Yeah.
So the traditional, everything goes to the monitor?
So in the traditional VM, some things go to the native CPU. This is this sort of jagged line. And some things go to the VM monitor.
And some go to the host OS.
And so, yes. And it turns out the way they're going to go to the VM monitor is they're going to go through the host OS. We'll get to that in a bit. And then we have emulators where the implementation or equivalent of the VM monitor translates everything to something for the host OS native CPU to use. We never actually run directly on the native CPU. We don't take the code that the guest OS gave and just run it. And both these strategies exist. And there's reasons you do both. So this is what you want to be doing if your sort of virtual instruction set is the same as the real one. If your machine is similar enough, you want to be running on your real hardware. It's a lot easier to implement. It's usually also a lot faster. This is useful if for some reason you can't make the privileged operations be forwarded, or if you want to run a different instruction set for some reason. Like, that is something that is practical to do. We don't see much virtual machine software use today doing it because everyone is using x86. But this is actually practical to do and at some points has been very common. So you can translate between ISAs, and also this gets around cases where somehow you can't do whatever magic is required to make privileged operations go to your virtual machine monitor. So this is not going to happen for free. So other questions on these two strategies? Yes.
What are privileged operations?
So privileged operations are things that ordinary programs aren't supposed to be able to do. I haven't precisely defined them, but a good example would be accessing a hard drive. Your ordinary program shouldn't be able to directly write random stuff to your hard drive. So that should be a privileged operation, which if you're running a normal program, would like cause an exception or something. It causes like a segfault or something like that. So we're gonna turn those operations into calls to the virtual machine monitor. And hopefully we can set up, the set of privileged operations is gonna be what we need to implement whatever interface we've decided we want for a virtual machine. That we can, all the things we want to keep the virtual machine from accessing directly, we can do that. And all the interfaces we want to give it, we can get interrupted into this privileged calls so we can do something about them rather than doing whatever the real hardware would do, even if that's give an error. Other questions? Yes? Instruction set architecture, which if you're in 3330, we'll cover next week. But it's basically what instructions exist. Okay, so I mentioned earlier that it's a resurgence of VMs starting with the late 90s. So VMs are shockingly old. So this is, it's a little hard to read, a snippet from the model, the marketing materials for the IBM 370 Model 158, which was announced in 1972, telling that you could have these virtual machines that are operated concurrently from remote terminals under multi-programming techniques. Advertising how awesome it is you can buy your nice big mainframe for your company and have these convenient virtual machines in 1972. This was a commercialized, widely available feature that was quite popular, quite successful for IBM. And then in the 80s, we forgot about it. And this is advocating a particular reason to want VMs, is that they say it turns it into an array of computers. So the idea is consolidation, that rather than buying 10 IBM 370s, you can just buy one. Isn't that so much better for your company? So much more convenient. So the idea, and this is a picture from a paper from 1974, the idea of VMs is that you have your machine interface and you have copies of that machine interface. So it just looks like you have more machine. That was the primary use case. It wasn't running a different OS on a machine. It was consolidation, that I want to have more computer than I really have. And there are sort of two issues which motivate this. So one is compatibility, that sometimes you want to run a particular version of the OS, you want to be sure that nothing's gonna break. So you want to customize the whole machine for some particular piece of software. And this is very attractive in old business environments where, you know, you're not gonna risk that your payroll system will break because you upgraded the OS. And with virtual machines, you didn't have to. You had an independent machine that wouldn't need to be upgraded all the time. It's also very good for efficiency. why would you have two CPUs, hard drives, etc., when you only have work enough in total for one? And when people look at sort of actual utilization of like big commercial systems, there's great motivation for this. So even in public clouds, which are trying to really use all their cycles to get all their money out of those machines they bought, or when people have tried to guess what their utilization is like as far as like CPU usage, like typical estimates are like less than 10%. And that's after doing some consolidation. So the motivation here is that it's just efficiency. It's not about security or isolation really, except for convenience of configuration. This is just sort of an economic argument for virtual machines. That we're gonna get a lot more efficiency, you know, because we never actually make full use of our hardware, and this is a way to make better use of the hardware by putting lots of machines on the same hardware. Yes, back there. So the question is, wouldn't it have been a lot slower in the 70s to use a virtual machine versus a real computer? So the answer is going to be, is basically no. So part of the reason for that is that people were doing less, so there was less to be slow about. Another part of the reason is that we had hardware support for this. This was a primary feature of what the hardware IBM was selling, and IBM made sure their hardware supported virtual machines well. And when you do that, it's actually surprisingly low overhead, especially if you're mostly doing computation. So VMs started with these mainframes, as I mentioned. Where the model was one, you buy one computer for your entire company. And splitting that into lots of machines makes a lot of sense. And then there was sort of VMs disappeared. And probably the reason for that was the personal computer. A computer on every desktop. If you can physically get a computer for everyone, why do you need virtual machines? It seems pretty wasteful. But motivations came around. So consolidation is still a big reason to use VMs. Still probably the biggest motivator for commercial virtual machine software today. And compatibility became a big concern. So one of the earlier uses in the 90s was like running Windows on a Mac. You could do that with virtual machine software, which was very useful for people who used Macs. And you've done it for Unix on Windows, or even different versions of Windows on Windows. And this is sort of exemplified, this resurgence by VMware, which came from academics figuring out how to implement VMs again, this time with less help from the hardware, which was very successful and bought by several companies, sort of starting this. So I alluded to VMs sort of having help from the hardware, being designed, the IBM machine that was this first big showcase for VMs, having hardware designed to run VMs. And that's one big strategy for implementing VMs, and originally probably the only viable way, maybe not. But hardware support, and it doesn't actually take that much, is one big way that virtual machines work. So our hardware is designed to make it possible to give you other machine interfaces, to let you implement virtual machines. Because this is very useful, so hardware designers have made sure that this is fast and easy to do. But there are alternatives, and there's some things we might want to do where we'll need one of those alternatives. And I'll mention these briefly. And I alluded to one of them, which is emulation, just converting from one set of instructions to another, which is going to be necessary when we want to have a completely different kind of instructions that we're running in our virtual machine than the real machine has, which is typically not what we're doing, but comes up. Okay, so the key idea behind hardware support is that hardware is going to have two modes. It's going to have a user mode, which is what your programs run in, and it's going to have a kernel mode, which is what some parts of your operating system run in. And the hardware is going to have a rule that privileged operations, things like accessing a hard drive, require kernel mode. That if you aren't in kernel mode, you can't do it. And of course, entering kernel mode is going to either be controlled or require a privileged operation. So you can't just decide, I want to run my program in kernel mode. That's not going to be allowed. The OS has to set that up for you. And there's going to be some boot process which initializes what runs in kernel mode and what doesn't. And there's something that we talked about at the end of 3330, which I'll go over briefly again, because even if you took 3330, you probably forgot it, which is exceptions. So I mentioned that privileged operations need to run in kernel mode, and we're going to run in our virtual machine, for our typical implementation strategy, we're just going to run the guest OS in user mode. So the privileged operations won't work. So the question is, what's going to happen? And what's going to happen is the equivalent of you getting a seg fault when you try to access invalid memory. The OS is going to get control from what is called an exception. This is a hardware feature where the hardware has decided, I'm going to make this do something different in user mode. And that's something different is let the OS decide what to do. It's going to run some code for the OS. And another example is that I/O devices might, you might press a key, and on your normal machine, that might cause your OS to run a program or something. And that happens because the hardware uses an exception to give control to the OS when you press a key. And this is all going to be, in our virtual machine case, to the host OS. So the way we're going to implement the virtual machine monitor is we're going to put these exception handlers in the virtual machine monitor. That if we go back to our picture diagram here, that we're going to have an exception which runs the host OS, and the host OS is somehow going to run the virtual machine monitor whenever those exceptions happen. So whenever we try to do a privileged operation, it will go to the host OS, which will run the virtual machine monitor and have it handle that operation and do what it should do as far as the fake machine is concerned. So conceptually, these exception handlers for anything which happens in our virtual machine, in our guest OS, is going to be implemented by the virtual machine monitor. And the job of that exception handler is going to be to look at what the guest OS was trying to do and basically interpret the instruction. So it's going to get something generic from the hardware just saying, this was privileged. You can't do this in user mode. And it's going to read the instruction and say, okay, this is a IO instruction for port number X. I'm going to look up what that means in the machine I'm simulating, and I'm going to emulate that operation, and then I'm going to start running the virtual machine at the next instruction. Okay, so this takes care of the part about implementing privileged operations. Yes?
Are exception handlers in the host OS, or are they part of the hardware?
So exception handlers are code in the host OS. And our virtual machine monitor implementation is going to somehow arrange with the host OS either to be in charge of the exception handlers instead, or to have the host OS exception handlers forward to the virtual machine monitor. Just call the virtual machine monitor instead of doing whatever else they were supposed to do. So on a privileged operation, this exception handler is going to emulate that privileged operation. So this is often called trap and emulate for that reason, this implementation strategy. When we have an external exception, something which gave control to the host OS, we want to mirror the effect in the virtual machine. So if I press a key on my keyboard, on the virtual keyboard, I want that to trigger an exception in the guest OS, not just in the host OS. So for something like this, the virtual machine monitor is going to look at this exception, this I/O, and it's going to say, what sort of I/O does this turn into in my virtual machine? And if it causes if it should have caused an exception, it's going to mirror that exception in the virtual machine. So it's going to cause the same thing which the hardware did to the host OS to happen with the guest OS. So it's going to start running a particular part of the guest OS code. Yes?
So if the VM sends a privilege call, does that go right to the hardware and then an exception is generated, or does that go to the VM monitor?
It goes to, so in this model, the VM is really running directly on the native CPU. Like, I have this picture here, but that's not quite what's happening. So yeah, it's going to go to the native CPU, which is going to send it to the host OS, which is going to send it to the virtual machine monitor. Because the native CPU is going to actually be reading that machine code and deciding what to do. But instead of what to do being the privileged operation, it's going to be go to the host OS. So any other questions on how this sort of trap and emulate for this case of trying to do a privileged operation and forwarding exceptions in the case where the host OS gets some indication that I/O happened? Any questions on sort of this concept? So to make that clearer, and also to talk about another thing. So in more detail, let's look at sort of a run-through example. And something I didn't get to is I sort of gave you the idea that we're going to always treat a privileged operation as a request to like access a disk. But you have to remember that we want to, you know, emulate a real machine. And a real machine supports user and kernel mode. So part of what our virtual machine monitor is going to do is it's going to have its own pretend notion of whether the virtual machine is in user or kernel mode. So this is a conceptual layering. It's not really what's happening since we're really running on the real hardware all the time. But conceptually, we're going to run a user program, and that's going to run on the virtual machine's notion of user mode, which is also going to be real machine user mode. But the guest OS running on the virtual machine thinks it's in kernel mode. It looks like it has control of the machine, which means it can do privileged operations. So it's running in this pretend kernel mode. It really is going to run in user mode along with the program, and our virtual machine monitor is going to have to remember which mode it's pretending to be in. And I mentioned with process virtual machines, one thing we do is we like access files. So who here can tell me what mechanism we use to do that, to communicate with the operating system that we want to access a file or something like that? If you've taken 3330, you should know this. Okay, back there. A trap. So, which is a kind of exception. So we can do something in user mode to deliberately trigger an exception to cause our OS to run. So if our user mode program is accessing a fake file, a file in the virtual machine, it's going to do a trap. And it's going to cause an exception. And just like with the case of me pressing a key, what should happen on this exception is that I should mirror that exception. It shouldn't be something which runs something in the virtual machine monitor and that virtual machine monitor accesses the file. That's not what should happen because the virtual machine monitor doesn't know about files. That's the guest OS's job. So the virtual machine monitor needs to call the guest OS to handle that request from this user, this pretend user mode program. This program that's conceptually running on the guest OS. So the flow is that we're going to be running our user program. And it's going to do a system call that's a type of trap, which is going to cause an exception. If we're running directly on the guest OS, instead of going to the virtual machine monitor, the hardware would start running the OS. But we aren't. Instead, we're running the virtual machine monitor / host OS. So the hardware is going to call a handler in the host operating system and conceptually in the virtual machine monitor which is going to handle that trap. And the virtual machine monitor is going to need to look at, in this handler, what happened and decide what to do. And its decision is going to be based on whether it thought it was running a normal program or the guest OS, whether it was running in kernel mode, pretend kernel mode or not. And in this case, it wasn't. So it needs to run the handler in the guest OS. That handler is still going to run in user mode on the real machine, but it needs to pretend to switch to kernel mode. And part of that is going to be updating what memory is accessible. Since another property about kernel versus user mode is you can access more memory. There's privileged memory in addition to privileged operations that you can access in kernel mode. And that's going to be one thing to do. So this handler is going to update what memory is accessible in user mode, and then it's going to switch to this handler, pretending that it's running in kernel mode. Remembering that if this handler, for example, tries to do some I/O, it's going to treat it as a request to do I/O rather than a request to call the guest OS. If it triggers an exception, that's going to be treated differently now because it knows that we're running the guest OS, not the guest OS's program. So questions about this? This is usually considered very confusing. So I assume people don't actually understand it. Yes? Yeah, so the general flow for any operation which causes an exception is going to be like this, except this final action, this action that the virtual machine monitor chooses might be different. So if the guest OS tries to do something privileged, that's going to cause an exception in the hardware, which is going to run a handler in the virtual machine monitor, which the virtual machine monitor, instead of for doing I/O, is going to do I/O to its pretend device. So it's a different action and response, but the mechanism for the virtual machine monitor getting control is the same. That these exceptions from either doing privileged operations or the guest programs requesting things from the guest OS are going to run the virtual machine monitor and allow it to do the little bit of glue to either communicate with the real device or communicate with the quote-unquote real OS. Other questions, comments? Yeah. The program runs the system call instruction. So conceptually, the program thinks it's making a system call to the guest OS. But this is how this is actually implemented by transferring control to the hardware, then to the virtual machine monitor, then to the hardware, then to the actual guest OS. But conceptually, the program thinks it's making a system call to the guest OS, just like it, you know, like you usually think of system calls in real hardware, that you're asking the OS to do something for you. Yeah, the hardware runs this instruction, which it knows is a trap, something which causes an exception, and the exception handler doesn't run the guest OS, but runs the virtual machine monitor instead. And the virtual machine monitor needs to do a little bit of extra work to run the guest OS's exception handler. And this extra work, in fact, is going to be like most of our overhead, why virtual machines run slower today, is because of this extra work. Yes? It's the program that implements the virtual machine. That's just the name for it. Another name you might see is hypervisor. But that's a common name for it. I'm using that instead of virtual machine because virtual machine, it's confusing whether it's referring to this program or sort of this thing. So this is why I use virtual machine monitor instead of virtual machine. Other questions? Okay. So that's the flow which virtual machines operate. And the key notion here is that the hardware gives us enough to fake other hardware, which is very useful. And let's talk about sort of what support we needed from the hardware to do that. The only sort of real support we needed is that the privileged operations, the things that we wanted to change what happened in the virtual machine versus the real machine, like accessing a hard drive, those things need to become exceptions. If they don't become exceptions, then it's a lot harder to implement virtual machines. Now, hardware can do extra stuff to make implementing virtual machines easier, and it often does. So, for example, I talked about changing the memory map. There's different, you can access OS memory in kernel mode and not in user mode. And in that picture I showed before, the virtual machine monitor needed to do some operation with the hardware to make that happen. And the hardware can make that easier. And one way this happens is something called nested page table lookup. So some hardware supports looking up something in one page table and then another, which makes it a lot easier to implement the memory support in virtual machine monitors. If you don't know what a page table is, you'll learn in 3330. But basically, it's what defines what memory is accessible to the running program. And having a nested lookup lets you have the guest OS decide what's accessible on top of the virtual machine monitor deciding what memory space the guest OS gets. And the hardware might support doing part of what usually the virtual machine monitor would have to do itself in hardware. So it might directly handle that forwarding of the system call to the guest OS, including changing the memory map. That might be a feature some hardware will support to make virtual machines faster. It's not necessary, but it can help. And implementing, you know, some read-only privilege instructions itself. So letting you set up those to not cause an exception, but to produce a result that makes sense in the virtual machine. Okay. So any questions about these sorts of things hardware can do? Yeah. Those are privileged operations on the real hardware, which better be the set of operations you want to change. Because if they aren't, so like if one of the operations you want to do something different isn't considered privileged, you're in trouble. And that can be the case sometimes. Okay, so this is sort of the standard way of implementing virtual machines, is that using this forwarding and maybe with some extra hardware help. And I mentioned that there were other techniques. I'm going to talk about one, which is going to seem probably pretty crazy. And that's called binary translation. We're going to compile assembly, or machine code actually, to new machine code at runtime. This works even if you're switching instruction sets. And yes, this has really been done. It seems crazy because it seems like this must be hideously inefficient, really hard to implement, especially for x86. But it's a real thing that is done. So you might ask, why would we do this? So, or how would we do this? So I'm going to go over sort of the basic idea, and apparently I decided to put extra stuff on my slide. Well, you can use the outside here. Okay, well, this is enough to explain. So let's say we have this bit of assembly code that we want to somehow translate into other assembly code. Our basic strategy for implementing binary translation is going to be to divide this code into what is called basic blocks. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a bunch of assembly code up to a jump of some sort. So what is called straight line code so code which doesn't do any sort of branches or anything, and compile that little snippet of code into another snippet of assembly code. So here we're translated into move RAX into RDI, so we've made something longer, but we're just translating this assembly code into other assembly. Just this block up to this conditional jump here. So we'll just take that and translate it to other assembly, and we'll do things like have a specific location where we know the original register values. The register values in the original assembly are stored. In this case, we've decided to put them somewhere in memory at a fixed location. So I'm not going to tell you how to do this by machine, but you can think of like taking this assembly code and by hand writing other assembly code. And maybe you have extra operations. Like maybe you want to check whether addition's overflow. You can easily do that if you write a different thing for add. And we're going to have memory locations instead of some registers, so we can use extra registers in our generated assembly. So when we do this translation here, we need to deal with the end. And that part is, fortunately, I didn't overlap two things. And the basic technique we're going to use to do that is we're going to jump to some translate and run at the end. So we're going to compute the address of the next instruction to run. Say put that in RDI here. And we're going to jump to a translate and run. We're going to jump to something which is going to look up what assembly is at that address and compile it to new generated code and run it. So that's how we're going to end each of these snippets. So people look very confused. So I'm sure I didn't explain this well in addition to messing up my slide. So questions or people not ready to do that? I'll do this thing. So the basic idea is we take a snippet of assembly that doesn't include any jumps, and we translate it to something new. So for example, if there's a privileged operation in there, we might turn that privileged operation into a function call. And when we have to do a jump in this assembly, we just call a function that instead of actually jumping to a memory location, will translate the next bit of assembly. We just compute what the next address we need to convert to code to run is and run that. Yeah?
So you translate one block.
Yeah.
It ends with the address of the next block to translate, which has not yet been translated.
Yes. And it ends with computing that address and then calling our translator again. So conceptually, we have this little loop where we generate a little bit of assembly, run it, and it goes back to our code to generate the next bit of assembly. Yes? So that's a good question, because this seems awfully inefficient. Why don't we just emulate it, like read the machine code and do it itself? And in fact, if we were doing that, that would be a good point. It usually will be slower. Not always, it can be faster. But we're gonna add some tricks onto this to make it actually end up being faster. And the biggest one is that we can cache our converted code. So in the original design, we just always translate whatever we jump to. With a little modification, instead of just translating whatever you jump to, you have a cache. You have a hash map of address and my prior translation, and you don't translate again if you already have a copy. So you don't regenerate code. So if you're writing a loop, that means you translate the body of the loop once, and then you just run that code you already generated again. And that's a lot faster. And if you're even more clever, you can patch the call to your translate function. You can turn that into a direct jump to your generated code. This requires a little lot of extra work, but it's worthwhile doing. So eventually, you end up recompiling that loop into a real loop. But you do it in a way where, along the way, you didn't need to identify that it was a loop. You just sort of found it naturally, because you tried to run it again, and you saw that, oh, I'm jumping to something already generated. Let me fix up that instead of calling my translate function. Let's just make it go directly. So when you do these tricks, it turns out that you basically have implemented a just-in-time compiler from machine code to new machine code. And if you also do things like don't actually keep every register in memory, like map some registers to real registers, you can make this, the generated code can be basically as fast as like compiled C code, or almost as fast. So questions about binary translation as sort of a technique? People probably still confused, yes. So caching and patching the calls to the translate function to just jump directly to the already converted code. So like if you have a loop, if when you go through it once, instead of sending an address to the translate function, you can change that code to just jump back to the converted code directly, which will be at a different address, of course, in real memory. Yes? It's converted into host code from guest code. Yes, because the host code is what runs on the real machine. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah. So this is actually going to be done in machine code. I just didn't show you machine code because that's awfully annoying. And typically it'll just be one. And I guess I'll move into sort of why you do this, which will probably make that clearer. So early VMware used a little bit of binary translation. And it was translating x86 to x86, which doesn't seem very useful. But the reason it needed to do this is that there were little bits of things that happened in OS code which couldn't be emulated correctly just by exceptions. There were some operations which behaved differently in user mode than kernel mode in a way which wasn't handled by just implementing an exception handler. So they wanted to fix those instructions. So their translation was basically keep everything the same but change a few instructions to do something different. Something that matches what a real machine does better in kernel mode, even though we're running in user mode. This has also been used to translate from one instruction set to another. So Apple has twice changed the instruction set their machines use, and each time they wanted you to be able to run programs for the prior machine. So first, they switched from a Motorola 68000, which is an old processor. You might see some embedded devices still, to PowerPC, and they made an emulator that was really fast using this sort of technique to run the old 68000 Mac applications on PowerPC without changing them. And similarly, they switched from PowerPC to Intel in 2005, and they provided an emulator which ran PowerPC on Intel using these techniques and was pretty fast. So the main reason they did this was not to like isolate things, but to provide the functionality that you had before on a different instruction set, to convert between two instruction sets. But it's also useful for VMs when you need to change the behavior of something and the hardware doesn't give you the tools to do that. Okay. So questions on these use cases? So since you have some exposure to x86, I might as well mention sort of the reason why we care about binary translation, why VMware needed binary translation. And this is mainly popf. So popf is an f86 instruction which pops flags from the stack. So these include things you know about, like condition codes. It also includes, say, the direction flag used by string instructions we'll talk about later, but includes some weird things, like the interrupt enable flag. The interrupt enable flag says whether hardware operations cause the exception handler to run right now. That that's not something you're supposed to be able to set from user mode. And you can't, in fact, set it from user mode. So what happens if you run popf in user mode? It works, and it just ignores whatever you put in this flag. You can say, I want to disable interrupts. It will just silently not do anything. And this is one of the instructions that VMware needed to fix, because some operating systems might try to set the flag this way, but they're running in user mode. It will silently not do that. So they needed to deal with that, and their solution was binary translation. So they looked for things like this popf instruction in the assembly and changed it to something else in order to make sure that when the operating system tried to set privilege flags this way, it would actually work correctly, even though the hardware at the time didn't give them the mechanism to actually do that. So that's sort of a motivation for doing binary translation. So there was another technique I mentioned, which was emulation. So my list of, two other techniques. So paravirtualization and emulation. So I'll start by talking briefly about paravirtualization. So paravirtualization is kind of a medium between doing something like binary translation, which, although it's reasonably fast, is really complicated to implement. There's a lot going on. You have to actually parse machine code correctly all over the place, which is a lot of work, and generate new machine code. You have to maintain this mapping. There's a significant performance overhead. And you might say, you're like, why was VMware spending all the time doing this for like only a few little things that OS code sometimes does, like this popf instruction in kernel mode? And another solution is you can say, why not make the OS change? There's actually not much OS code that's going to deal with the privileged operations you need to change. Why don't you make the OS and just change that OS code? And this is the idea of paravirtualization, that we're going to make the OS code that deals with these, you know, particular I/O devices, which or hardware operations that are emulated correctly, we're just going to change that in the OS. It might be as simple as a device driver, it might be a little more work, but we're just going to make those little changes, and then we're going to run this slightly modified OS. And this is what Xen has traditionally done, maybe not anymore, but originally, this was the model Xen had, and it's a lot faster than binary translation, and it gives you some advantages that you can change operations which would ordinarily require some expensive sequence of exceptions, like if it was multiple privileged instructions, you can turn them into something simpler that's more useful for the OS. So it's kind of a compromise between that system virtual machine where it looks exactly like real hardware and the process model. And the other technique is just emulation. And Box is an example of an x86 emulator. So emulation means you have a loop, you read an instruction, and you just write out the code to do what the instruction says and do it. You just have that like in a loop. You have if it's move, then copy. If it's add, then add two numbers, and so on. So it's the absolute most straightforward way. The disadvantage is that it's like 1,000 times slower than the real machine. Whereas these other techniques here are between the same speed as the real machine and like maybe 5 times slower. And pardon me, I do that and see really. I thought I had more slides, and which meant I made a mistake. Yeah, okay. So let's go, I'm gonna move on to talking about why about virtual machines and sort of security issues. Since we sort of talked about implementing them and the utility that we can provide this sort of isolated environment is what we actually care about in this class. So we don't care that how much it looks like the real machine, that much. What we care about is that we give the isolation from the dangers of the real system. So the key idea that we're going to benefit from virtual machines is that when you do something in a virtual machine, you can't access the real machine. This means if I run malicious software in the virtual machine, I can't actually worry about that software, say, deleting all my files, probably. And this is what we want to do if we think we have malware. We want to run it probably in a virtual machine. You don't want to put it on your real system. You want to put it in the virtual machine. That's why security researchers really care about virtual machines. And this is something where we want something different than typically what virtual machines want. So you want to run the bad software in as realistic an environment as possible. And we want to run not just like normal software, we want to care about whether it's bad. So we want to run dangerous stuff safely, and we want to analyze dangerous stuff without it knowing, without changing how it operates. And some of these are going to be easier or harder than others. So isolation is, in fact, for some things, is very good. So in VMs, it's really easy not to give the VM access to the network. And that's really valuable if you're dealing with evil software. It's also really easy not to give the VM access to the real disk. You can give it a fake disk, and you can even make a copy of that fake disk so you know it changed. You don't have to worry about the virtual machine infecting your real files. It's only infecting the files on the VM if you configure it properly. And because these are virtualized resources, and this disk is virtualized, just said you can make a copy of it. And commonly, VMs have snapshots. So you can make a snapshot of the state of the VM, let some evil software do something to it, and look at what changed. And or go back to a previous state and see what would happen if I ran the evil software differently. And this aids sort of analyzing what's going on. You can see what damage it does. You can go back before damage happened. You can try to look at it in the middle if it tries to erase its traces. This is valuable for analysis. And these are, in fact, pretty efficient to implement, which is nice. So it's like taking a snapshot doesn't mean actually taking a copy of your entire disk. There are better techniques for implementing that. So basically, what the VM will do is it will just keep a list of what updates you made. So the VM, when the VM reads and writes the fake disk, it looks at that list, gives it what's in the list if it's there. Otherwise, it goes to the base copy. And this means that snapshots are very efficient to make, that you can take lots of them, so you can have all these sorts of different ideas about what's happening when we're looking at evil software, what evil software does. And you can easily have multiple snapshots with the same base, so you can look at different cases, and go back and do what-if checks, and sort of get an idea what some software is doing. So this is good for analysis, and VMs are very helpful for analysis because of this isolation and the ability to sort of look at particular points in the environment. And they're also good for just debugging. So when you know about using debuggers on operating systems, but debugging an entire OS is harder, and that's something that virtual machines enable. And they can do it in a way which is more subtle and won't be interfered with by weird code. Like, they don't care what's running as much as your process debugger. They don't care if it's multiple processes. It's a simulated processor. It will tell you what that simulated processor is doing. And often, as we'll learn later, bad software, malware, is going to try to interfere with debuggers, and virtual machines can isolate them enough from what's really happening that this is going to be very hard to do. So in addition to giving you sort of whole machine debugging, this gives you debugging that is potentially not interfered with by people who wanted to make debuggers not work, which seems like an awfully bad thing to do. How would you ever develop software that way? But it's something that malware creators do. So when I talked about using the reasons we care, we wanted to run dangerous stuff safely. And a good question is, are VMs safe? And I have this notion that you don't have a real network, you don't have a real disk, so you're safe. But this isn't always true. There have been bugs in virtual machines which allow what's called virtual machine escape. That something is running in this container of the virtual machine and it gets out. It's out of its cage. These are real bugs which exist and have existed and are usually quickly patched. There is a some in VMware in 2009. There was in 2015, there was a big Xen bug, and all the major cloud providers basically use Xen. And these were things which risked allowing an operating system to run in the real OS and do all the things we want to isolate it from doing. So these are real bugs, and they happen, and they're something we can be concerned about. Fortunately, they're less common than these sort of equivalent bugs in real operating systems. It's much easier for the operating system to allow a process to do more than it should do. And the big reason is that point I alluded to earlier, which is that the process interface is much bigger. There's a lot more to look at as far as whether everything works the way it should. Having the virtual machine interface is really actually smaller, and that means that there's a lot less to look at the code-wise about whether it does the right thing. And that's why these bugs are a lot less common, but they still have happened. And there's hope that maybe we can prove that they don't happen, and maybe hardware support will make it harder for them to happen, but they're a real thing to be concerned about. So earlier I talked about bad software wanting to keep you from debugging it, because you know that if you can debug the ransomware, you might be able to figure out how it works and you know make them not get their money. And just like they want to keep you from debugging it, they also want to keep you from running it in VMs, because that would be a convenient way for figuring out what it's doing. And so there's work on where malware tries to detect virtual machines. And the key reason that this is possible is that, you know, on this picture, this is labeled basic machine interface, and it should be the same interface. But is it really the same interface? And usually the answer is no. So normal VMs are just not stealthy, because they're not designed for malware analysis. They're not designed to deal with malicious software that cares about whether it's on a VM or not. They want to run things efficiently. In fact, here's a Linux program manual for virtwhat, which will just tell you what virtual machines you're running on right now. It's pretty good. And it works because these virtual machines aren't very subtle. So DMI decode reads a data structure provided by the booting hardware, by the motherboard, for telling you about what type of system you're running on. This is used by operating systems to know, hey, how do I talk to the keyboard and the hard drive, especially during boot. So this is a nice data structure, and DMI decode is a program for accessing that. And you can see here, I'm running it in a VM, and whoa, it just says VirtualBox. There you go. Not even trying to hide it. And if malware wants not to work well in a VM, it will probably do something about this. And we've seen real malware in the wild actually does this sort of thing. It does things where it tries to detect whether it's running in a virtual machine, just because it knows that people who want to, you know, do something about this malware are going to run it in a virtual machine. So, for example, malware searches for VMware with device names and device drivers commonly used in VMs, and also does heuristic checks. Like, it looks to see if the processor is a little slow for some operations. Things that would happen because of that extra overhead where we had to talk to the virtual machine monitor to talk to our guest OS. So it tries to do some timing. And this is a big problem, so you can't be perfect. Like, conceptually, there's no reason why I can't make perfectly undetectable VMs, but it's really hard. And there's other things which could happen, like if you don't implement some operation that real hardware does, that could be detectable. It's a very subtle problem and sort of not something you can do precisely, but if you're manually analyzing evil software, you can, as is typically done apparently, just remove this check as you're analyzing it. That's the common fix, is to edit the software and then proceed with the rest of your analysis. So any questions on sort of how these VM detection might work? Yeah. The most common thing that malware would do differently is it would not performance attack. It wants to look like non-malicious software, or at least not make its malicious code obvious in a VM. So ironically, this means that you might be safe for running things in a VM just because malware offers don't like their stuff working in a VM. But this is good for them because that means when an antivirus company tries to analyze it, it will take them more time to actually figure out what it's doing and therefore update their antivirus software to deal with that. Other questions? So in addition to being the primary way to sort of analyze malicious code, VMs are also sort of an actual technique used directly to try to combat malware, which is the other reason why they're not going to do malicious things typically in a VM if they think they're running in it. If you want to know if software does something bad, wouldn't it be great to just run it and see what it does? And this is something that real antivirus software does. It basically has some sort of lightweight VM. It takes something it thinks might be malware, runs it for a while in that, and sees if it does anything bad. And because this is isolated from the real system, you know, it doesn't need to worry about changing anything in the real system, and it can look for bad things, like, say, modifying executables. If it does that, it's probably bad. And this is really used, and it's a nice technique because conceptually it's hard to think of how you defeat it. Unlike many other techniques we'll talk about, this is sort of goes directly at what bad things the malware is trying to do. So it's not something where you can make a trivial change to it and defeat it, probably. Except, as we might talk about later, that's not quite true. So this is actually an anti-malware technique that's really used. And in our remaining few moments, I'll talk about why we're using VMs in this course. So VMs really are a valuable technique for analyzing dangerous stuff in isolation. We're not actually going to have you analyze real malware, probably, at least not any actually dangerous malware. Our main reason for using VMs is more of one of those practical ones. It's about that configurability. So we're going to talk about exploits later in the course. And our exploits are going to care about exact memory addresses and the exact version of system libraries, potentially. And I'm going to test on a particular system. I'd like you to have the exact same system. So a question you might have, if exploits are this sensitive, how does any malicious software actually exploit anything? Like, if it's going to break with a different version of a library. And there's several things to say. So one is that they're fragile, not broken. So like, it will probably work on a different version of Linux, but I'm not going to guarantee it, and I certainly think you don't want to get a zero in an assignment because of differences between versions of Linux that may or may not happen sometimes. Also, you can make exploits less fragile. I'll mention that in a bit. And you know, some malicious software just generates all the variations. So like the slapper worm had 23 different variations of its exploit for different memory layouts, for different versions of libraries and programs compiled for different systems. It's not actually hard to do. And that's all I have for today. So, notes, so ethics pledge, if you want a blank one, I have it here. If you want to hand one in, use that envelope.